You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row. And this episode is presented by Emma Louise Fenelon.
Hello, LawPod listeners. I have a real treat in store for you. My guest today is John Gimlett. John has practiced at One Crown Office Row for over 35 years, and in that time, he's become expert in clinical negligence and personal injury, appearing numerous times in the Court of Appeal and once in the Supreme Court. And a trawl through Westlaw for mentions of his name reveals cases as varied as whiplash injuries, action estoppel, the complexities of interpreting the legal aid rules, and high-value clinical negligence claims. John was also editor of two practitioner textbooks. And you might think that that would be enough to be getting on with, but John has another string to his bow, travel writing. And while practicing as a barrister in Temple, found the time to publish five travel books, write for newspapers and magazines, and contribute to BBC travel programmes. He has been described, and I hope he's blushing at this, as the world's best living travel writer, and has won numerous awards, more than I can be bothered to mention in introduction, for his travel books, and been lauded by the New York Times, The Telegraph, many others. John, it's such a pleasure to have you on the podcast for the very first time.
Thank you, Emma. It's a delight to be here. Thank you very much for asking me on. Wonderful.
Now, John, Wikipedia says that at 17, you crossed the former Soviet Union by train, which makes me think that you were an intrepid sort from early on. But can I ask, how did you get into travel writing? And I should pause here and say that one member of Chambers, who shall remain nameless, has suggested that it was almost entirely his idea.
Yeah, well, it's funny. Yes, the writing starts, obviously, with travel, and I've been traveling all my life. It's pretty much in the blood, to be honest. And that trip on the Trans-Siberian came about because I went to stay with friends in Hong Kong during the school holiday. And my mother thought, it's a bit expensive getting back. But she'd found this way of putting me on the train across the Soviet Union. And I could get home from Hong Kong for 100 quid. What I didn't know, it was 8,000 miles and nearly 10 days of traveling. But it was a great experience, and it left me thinking, if I can do that at 17 on my way back to school, I can do anything. So it all starts with travel. And from then, my career choices originally were things like wanting to work for the United Nations and the UNHCR. I was very keen on when I was a student. But increasingly, I realized that if I really did want to see the world, my chances of doing so were probably as good being a barrister as anything else. So the travel carried on. It changed when I was about 35, after tube journey, when there was a sliding doors moment, when I looked up and there was an ad for a travel writing competition organized by The Spectator. And I wasn't in court the next day, so I thought, give it a go. So I wrote it.
That's so wonderful.
John Whiting looked at it and said, looks okay. I whizzed it across town to meet the midnight deadline. And to my surprise, it won. And that's when everything changed, because I suddenly realized that people might be interested in reading what I want to say. So yeah, that's how it all began.
And you've, since that point, written about countries as varied as, or regions, I should say, as varied as South America, Europe via the route of the US forces of 1944 to 45, Sri Lanka, Madagascar. And I wanted to ask, how do you decide which country to write about or which region to write about? And once you've chosen a country or region, what's your process?
Okay, right. What all these places, except the European journey, have in common is they tend to be places that have got their own history that doesn't bleed into their neighbours' history. So, you know, Madagascar, Paraguay, and so on. That's what they have in common. The European journey was slightly different. That came about because I met a US war veteran in London and said, have you been to Europe before? And he said, yes, I went through France and Germany and Innsbruck. And I said, fantastic journey. He said, well, no, it was 60 years ago. Cutting a long story short, he agreed to come with me. The other journeys were different. Paraguay, I originally went to as a refugee because in the period between school and university, I worked on an estancia in Argentina, and I was meant to stay there for most of my 6 months or so, but the Falklands War started. And so I had to hightail it out of Argentina, and I hitched a lift with some cigarette smugglers who were taking an empty truck back to Paraguay. And we had a very jolly journey up through Corrientes province and into Paraguay. And I got to Asuncion and I just loved it. I just thought this is the most surreal place. This is a country with its own music, its own impressionist movement. Paraguayans are charitable, kind, generous. They love fighting, it seems. They've taken on all their neighbors in the last 100 years or so. And I just thought this place was magical. So 20 years later, I went back and read the book. Sri Lanka, slightly different. I live near Tooting, and I got to know a lot of the Tamils there. A lot of them are great supporters of the Tamil Tigers. I'm no friend of the Tamil Tigers, but I found the story interesting. And that was my entree into what is essentially a sort of walk through the Lankan Civil War. Guyana is a little bit different. That was due to a very distant ancestor who died there in 1628. He's described as the first person to write poetry from the New World. I should add, it's absolutely terrible stuff. It's doggerel. But it is at least some form of poetry. He didn't last. He was there for a month or two before he died of dysentery. It did pique the interest. So there you are. It's all sorts of different reasons. You asked how I manage this. Well, I tend to do about 18 months to 2 years research before, and I know exactly what I'm looking for when I go there, and every day is busy, yeah.
I can only imagine what it must have been like to hightail it out of Argentina at the beginning of the Falklands War. I have to say, none of these stories are doing anything to dampen our reputation as having probably the most exciting career of any one of us at One Crown Office Row. But back to that practice that you built alongside your writing, can I ask, how did you balance that? How did your solicitors react when you left London to live somewhere much more tropical sounding to do research? And what did you do with your presumably long running cases while you were away?
Well, Emma, yeah, this was always potentially a problem. And what I've done, I've tended to do over the years, is keep my two lives very separate. I don't tell solicitors, I don't make a big thing of it, at any rate, that I do something else. And many solicitors over the years have absolutely no idea that I also write articles for newspapers on travel or write travel books. And that's fine. And I don't promote the travel as part of my legal career because I always think, well, it's a bit like if you want a dentist, you're not really interested in the fact they're also a stand-up comedian. You just want a dentist. And I don't think solicitors really are interested or want their barrister to be anything other than the barrister. So I have kept them very separate. It has been impossible in some cases, but my main work has come through several solicitors, which I've known for many, many years, and they've been extremely tolerant of it. The solicitor I was working with yesterday, I've known for 35 years, and she and I have worked together over many, many cases. So they've been very generous and very tolerant. But, you know, it's about building relationships. I have relationships with these people, and that's how it works. Yeah, it is difficult being away for 3 months. The first few books, when I went to Paraguay, for example, I would literally sign off for 3 months. And that was pretty uncomfortable in terms of coming back and still having a practice. In later books, as my legal career got more complex, as I became a senior junior, going away for 3 months would have been difficult. So I tended to break it down to two lots of a month and a half, or sometimes even less than that. But generally speaking, I could work it out. And what I do is book it out plenty of time in advance. And then the writing also needed time. And what I do then is just see spots in the diary between trials and just book them out and go for it. It's not been popular with those who manage my diary, but yeah, it's just about worked.
Can I ask, in terms of the extent to which there's any overlap between, I don't want to use the skills, I mean, this isn't a HR interview, but you know, the part of your brain that you're using when you sit down to plead something and the part of your brain that you're using when you sit down to describe what you're seeing or the background to a country and its history. Is there any overlap? Is there benefits to one or the other because you're doing both? And I should say at this stage that Legal 500 has quoted you as having a particularly attractive way of drafting pleadings. And other directories have mentioned your excellent attention to detail. So I asked that loaded question.
That's very nice. Yes, I suppose there is some connection between travel writing and a legal practice in the sense that both involve very often telling a story and telling a story from a vast amount of material. You know, if you're doing a clinical negligence case, even a relatively modest one, there are probably at least three lever arch files of medical records and reports and so on. And it has to be distilled down into something coherent. And the process of writing a travel book has been very similar. So my research for Sri Lanka, for example, will fill several lever arch files. And then I go there and I interview all sorts of people, cricketers, former heads of state, former terrorists, people in the army, sportsmen, all sorts of people, and fill these diaries with interviews and experiences and so on. And then somehow that all has to be assimilated. So the giant essay plan gets written. And in some ways, it does feel like putting together a complex case. So there is that. More than that, it would be difficult to say that one helps or feeds the other. But I will say this, that I think the experience of travel, particularly following very difficult stories, it might be visiting the site of the Jonestown massacre in Guyana or going to the battlefields of Sri Lanka, these are the 2009 battlefields, or going to areas where there's been the terrible outbreaks of crime, and I'm talking about Madagascar, rural crime, and these sort of low-grade, continuous country warfare. All of that, and many other types of travel, make you really appreciate the legal system we have. You know, most of the people I'm coming across on these journeys just have no recourse to law at all. They may lose lives, or family, or whatever. And there's just nothing they can do about it. And as for medical negligence, a lot of these places that I've been to just don't have a medical negligence litigation facility. For Madagascar, it's a completely alien concept, the idea that you could sue your doctor. People were mystified by what I was doing. The medicine itself is pretty basic. Madagascar, when I was there, only had one CT scanner in the entire country and no neurosurgeon. So if you haven't got quite a lot of your medicine in place, it's perhaps unsurprising you don't have your medical negligence in place. So there's that. There's the appreciation of what we have here. It makes me also think what we have here is somewhat luxurious. We have a really top-notch litigation system for making claims, possibly too luxurious. And compared to countries that have nothing, it's frankly unbelievable. But yes, there's that appreciation.
I'm struck by one of the things that you said about solicitors really only being interested in what you have to offer as a barrister, because you've obviously been in practice for now almost 40 years. And I can only imagine that things have changed enormously at the bar in that time. And one of the things that has obviously changed is that there are far more women in practice, and in particular, far more primary carers in practice. Statistically, most of those are still mothers, but there are obviously also primary carer fathers as well. And I do wonder, how do you perceive the bar to have changed in that time, bearing in mind what you said about, you know, solicitors really wanting barristers to stay in their lane?
Yes, I think your point about there being more women at the bar points to a generally much more friendly and accessible bar than the one I joined. And that is all to the good. The bar I joined was lovely in a sort of slightly old-fashioned way, but it was very hierarchical and certainly very patriarchal, but very hierarchical. Even within chambers, when you started, the people at the top of chambers seemed quite remote and quite inaccessible, despite their efforts to be otherwise. There just wasn't really a route through to them. And we knew our place for the first few years, and perhaps it continued. I still feel slightly in awe of those people now long since retired. Whenever I still see them, I still feel that sense of hierarchy that exists. It was also a much simpler life in many ways. You can imagine the desk that I came to in 1986. It had a phone, a pad, and a pen. And when papers came in, and they came in just folded over pieces of paper rather than in boxes or in electronic files, and you did your device in ink pen, you sent it to the secretaries, they took a week or so to type it, they sent it back, you corrected it, the corrections took 4 or 5 days, and the process of just writing it took a couple of weeks, really. And so some people were taking several months to return papers by the time they got around to looking at them and then typing them and so on. And then the brief often came, if you were doing criminal law, quite late at night. So we'd all go down to Victoria Station. We'd hang around in the Red Star office for the papers. And then you'd quickly read them. And then the next morning, you'd be off to represent this person at their plea or trial or whatever. That has, of course, all changed. The digital age has replaced all of that, obviously, and it's gone. And that's much better. But it's also lost something as well, in that we now work increasingly in a rather digital, virtual world as practitioners. And during my day, there are fewer and fewer interactions, real-time, real interactions with people. And I do miss that. It was better in that respect in the old times. So yeah, good and bad, but I leave a very, very different profession.
And a slightly more personal question, but one of the things that I'm struck by is that you built up expertise and excellence in the areas that you did. You've appeared in the highest courts in the UK and did all that alongside being lauded for your various travel books. But I wonder, given that the bar is so competitive and at times brutally competitive and for many all-consuming, did it ever bother you when you saw others that you came up with, your contemporaries, going on to take Silk or going on the bench?
No, it really didn't, because when that moment happened, when I was 35, of winning this competition, The Spectator, and launched me on this new sideline of writing, first of all, for newspapers, which I still do, but also books, I realized then that this is really what I wanted to do. And much though I enjoyed my career at the bar, and particularly enjoyed the claimant's work and the clients that I had there, and some of whom I'm still in touch with 10 years on, despite that enjoyment, I realized that my heart was really in the writing. And if I was going to seek validation in life or self-validation, it was through some of the things that those journeys produced. The encounters, it might be encounters with cannibals in Paraguay, or Nazis, or former Nazis, or four heads of state. Or it might be the places that I've been to, crossing a very high alpine pass in Austria, or being one of the first Europeans to some of the battlefields in Sri Lanka. The army opened them up about the time I was there, and with a military chaperone, off I go. And also going to Jonestown in Guyana, which is the scene, as you will know, of the massacre in the late 70s. And again, very few people had been to these places. And there, it wasn't just about seeing what was left of Jonestown after this terrible catastrophe, but also understanding its legacy and talking to the people who'd witnessed it and survived it. Now, I feel immensely privileged to have done and seen these things, and that gives me validation. To be honest, I don't worry that my legal career hasn't gone to the stellar heights of my peers. I'm very happy with what I've done, and I do it all over again at a shot.
That's so lovely to hear, particularly in an era of burnout and increased awareness of well-being and 24/7 expectations around availability. It is very nice to hear somebody senior talking about alternative approaches to their own validation. So final question then, what would you say to anyone considering combining a career at the bar with something else entirely? And I'm not even speaking about travel writing necessarily, but just having another significant wing to their bow. So I'm not necessarily talking about a hobby. I'm talking about something that they really invest time and effort and to a degree sacrifice in order to pursue.
I mean, I think sacrifice is probably the key word there, because you have to appreciate that if you are going to follow a passion as a secondary career, something's got to give. You can't simply expect to run both perfectly in parallel. And as we've discussed, something has had to give in my legal career. But if you do have a passion, then yes, I'd be the first to encourage it. And there are plenty of people who have run very successful parallel careers. There's some people who've run stellar parallel careers, like Jonathan Sumption, as the historian, as well as an extremely eminent lawyer and judge.
I will jump in there, John, and say I'm pretty sure you're up there with them, but but please do go on.
but also, Trollope ran the post office while he was writing 40 novels. Now, I don't like to mention myself in the same breath as them, but all I'm saying is you can successfully do both, but just be realistic and accept that, generally speaking, for most of us mortals, something will have to give.
Well, John, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We will include links to each of your travel books, and if you would like us to, your Wikipedia page, in the blog post accompanying this podcast. But thank you so much for giving our listeners an insight into what it's like to have this dual career, a dual life, really. Thank you.
Well, Emma, thank you. And thank you for your extremely insightful questions. I really enjoyed it. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
This episode of LawPod UK was presented by Emma Louise Fenelon. The series is produced by One Crown Office Row.